This next session, our final breakout session. We have one more with the Premier and the Governor, but the last one with a larger group. This is where the speaker says, "Allô, s'il vous plaît, allô." Thank you. So on this session, we're doing energy and sustainability, energy and the environment, in effect, and reframing some of these issues around climate change to clean energy. As some of you who may have seen or read President Obama's State of the Union address a few weeks ago in January, there were three references to clean energy in the State of the Union and no references to climate change. That doesn't happen by accident in a State of the Union speech. Not at all, as Ambassador Giffen can tell us. Gordon Giffen is the former U.S. ambassador to Canada during the Clinton years, now practicing law in Atlanta and director of several important Canadian companies. Thierry Vandal is the president and CEO of Hydro-Québec, North America's, and I think the world's largest hydroelectric utility, number one in the world, right? Hydroelectric. And Pat Daniel is joining us from Calgary, is the president and CEO of Enbridge, a major North American pipeline player in the energy space. And our moderator is my good friend and contributing writer to Policy Options, Velma McCall, who has a leading environmental and energy practice with the Earnscliffe Strategy Group in Ottawa. Take it away, Velma.
So we heard about businesses that operate in Canada and the U.S., and we've got some leading CEOs who already are very familiar with energy in a North American context, and Ambassador Giffen, who certainly knows North America from his time as Canada's ambassador, or the U.S. ambassador to Canada, excuse me. The mic threw me off there. I'm just going to start with a couple of boilerplate things because I think that in many ways the Canada-U.S. energy and sustainability relationship is something that we take for granted. It's something that it's already very integrated. Canada supplies 9% of total energy to the U.S. We're 90% of all natural gas imports and 15% of total U.S. consumption. Fully integrated electricity grid and supply almost all of each other's electricity. Imports and exports, and hydroelectricity is, of course, key to that. And we also supply one-third of the uranium that the U.S. uses. On the sustainability side, we heard last night from Prime Minister Mulroney about the successes that we've had with acid rain, with POPs, with an Arctic treaty, with migratory birds. We have a history of successes in bilateral environmental cooperation, and I think that that's something that we can build on. Now, we haven't quite figured out the energy and climate change relationship. We've all heard a lot about that. But before we get into a discussion of that, I thought what we would do is we'd start with Thierry and let him just talk a little bit about what it is that Hydro-Québec is working on.
Sure. Thanks so much. I mean, this is such a distinguished audience and this distinguished panel, with Ambassador Giffen, good friend, Pat Daniels, and I thought I'd take a few notes just to keep this fairly scripted. what I think, obviously Hydro-Québec is in the business of energy and sustainability, as we'll have a chance to exchange on, but when I think of energy and sustainability, and to take this away a bit from Hydro-Québec and put it in a broader context, when I think of energy and sustainability, I think of a number of things. First, I think of investment and the need to sustain very significant investments, investments in infrastructure, investments in resource development of all forms, because you're looking at a very broad energy mix in North America, and investment in technology and the great importance of technology, both technology in terms of how we produce energy, but also technology in terms of how we use energy. And this is where I bring in the question of energy efficiency in the context of really sustaining very significant investments in technology. Hydro-Québec obviously is active in all those fronts, resource investment, transmission, infrastructure investment, and very, very significant technology plays which I'd love to get back on. When I think of energy and sustainability, I also think, obviously, of growing the renewable portion of our energy mix. We have a very broad and very diverse energy mix in North America, and I think we're all working. I know Pat, as our organization, is also, and we are obviously working on growing the renewable portion of the energy mix. You know, the best guarantee of sustainability is when you have something that's renewable in North America. Obviously, energy sustainability is also about North-South trade. The relationship to our great friends in the U.S. is one of sustaining very significant trade. It's North-South and it's in terms of how we move energy in North America to a great extent, oil, gas in the West, obviously hydroelectricity, electricity in general in the East. When I think of energy and sustainability, finally, I think also of a paradigm shift that is, I think, will be happening in the coming years, and certainly in the context of what's going on around the world. You know, if we had sat here 6 months ago and said that two of the most stable regimes in the Middle East, Egypt and Tunisia, would have a regime change, that you'd have a civil war in Libya, that you'd have major, major protest movements in countries like Syria. You'd have the monarchies of Saudi Arabia moving troops into Bahrain, monarchies of Jordan and Morocco facing some civil, you know, significant civil tensions. I think we would have said, hey, this is a very, very volatile world. Well, this is the world in which we live in. And in that context, I think there's a tremendous opportunity and a paradigm shift for our societies if we move in the direction of electrifying a significant portion of road transportation. And I think here of collective mass transit, where we can do much more in terms of electrifying that mass transit system, and also light duty. We're not going to electrify, obviously, air or rail, but we can certainly, or heavy-duty transportation, but in terms of light-duty vehicles in North America, we can do a lot in terms of moving towards electricity, in that sense, moving towards the use of less oil and more North American resources, be they natural gas or renewable power. So that, to us, how to go back is really how we frame the discussion around energy and sustainability.
Pat, do you want to jump in there? He gave you a nice segue.
Yes, yeah, I would love to jump in. And I'm going to spare everybody the Enbridge commercial because I've been in Montreal a couple of days this week doing investor relations meetings, and I'm worn out on giving the commercial, and I know you don't want to hear it either. So let me talk about energy interdependence between Canada and the U.S. because I think that's very relevant. Did I just lose
yes.
the microphone?
Oh, there you are.
It's yep. back. I think that's very relevant to the things that we're going to talk about. And there's no doubt that in the oil and gas business, which is much more my area specialty than electricity, that we've got highly interdependent energy markets between Canada and the U.S. But I think a very important point for Canadians to keep in mind is that you have to watch your definition of interdependence. And as Velma indicated, the U.S. has many sources of import, particularly when it comes to crude oil. Canada represents about 20% of the crude oil the U.S. Brings in via imports. But they are our sole export market, so 100% of Canadian exports go to the U.S. That means that if you use the word interdependent, we're the dependent side of the interdependent word. And that's one of the reasons why Enbridge is very involved in an initiative to build a new crude oil pipeline to the West Coast to be able to access markets in Southeast Asia, to broaden out the trade relationships for Canada around the world, and to make this more truly an interdependent market. And I think our U.S. customers will benefit from that as well, because the broader market, the more investment in energy in Canada, and therefore the greater the supply ultimately for our U.S. friends. And I want to make sure that I emphasize that even though we're very involved in this initiative to broaden markets to Southeast Asia, there is no doubt that for crude oil and natural gas, the U.S. will be our biggest market, always will be, always has been. But we just do need, in my view, an alternative. And of course, that will apply, I think, not only to oil, but in the future to natural gas as well, as we look at moving liquefied natural gas off the West Coast. In addition to that interdependence issue, security supply, for reasons Thierry mentioned, and worldwide disruptions and political disruptions in particular, will mean that this relationship between Canada and the U.S. is even more important to our U.S. customers. Canada is obviously viewed as a friendly supplier of energy, and hence very good reasons to further strengthen the relationship. I personally think the security of supply will win out any day over the environmental issues, issues around dirty oil from Canada or other energy supplies, because we are considered and are a very friendly neighbor to the U.S. So that's important, and I guess the final point that I would like to leave is that it is very important to ensure that we're coordinated on the issue of greenhouse gas emission legislation, whether it be via carbon tax or GHG restrictions. We have to make sure we keep a balanced investing playing field in North America and not overly penalize production from one area or region of North America against another, or we're going to distort the investment dynamics. And it's very important to Canadians, of course, to have those investment dollars coming in. If we put any kind of a penalty in place that's out of sync with what happens in the U.S., I don't think it's going to work. So very important that we work together, and we have been to date, to ensure that we've got a unified and harmonized system for greenhouse gas emission control.
Gordon, can I ask you to chime in here?
Sure. Thank you, Velma. It's a delight to be here with my two friends. It's also great to be in Montreal. I actually grew up in Montreal. I moved here when I was 6 weeks old and finished seventh grade in a little town called Valois that now doesn't exist, but it is on the train. There's a Valois stop there, but Valois doesn't exist. Anyway, it's delightful to be here. I left Canada after high school and went to the McGill of the South, Duke University. I was going to talk about basketball until last night.
Yeah, right.
Energy. We're here to talk about energy and the environment.
And sustainability. Yeah.
The fact is Canada has it. The United States needs it. And when I say it, I mean the entire menu of energy right across the board. And I think it's awfully important. Sometimes these discussions, particularly in the U.S., get off on a given energy source. It's important in the U.S. for us to recognize as a policy matter that while sustainability and environmental considerations are without doubt very important, that we are going to be consuming as a society all varieties of energy for quite some time, and whatever variety it is, we have to do it in a responsible fashion. The U.S. has been an irresponsible consumer historically. But we have to be responsible, and no particular source of energy should be at war with the other in that context, as long as we recognize that the framework is responsible use of energy. Now, when I'm in Canada, people always refer to the context as Canada is the largest supplier of oil or electricity or natural gas. That's not true. Companies, enterprises in Canada are doing it. But I think it's important. There's, the approach to this, I think, in Canada, and sometimes it's used by political figures in Canada as a political issue. We can lever the United States to agree with us on something because we supply the most energy. Well, you really don't. It's Hydro-Quebec supplying energy. It's through your pipelines, a lot of producers in Western Canada. So I think it's important in the dialogue in the U.S. to not make this a geopolitical conversation. It's an energy conversation, and it's a commercial conversation. Just like the gentleman who is selling suits to the United States, he looks at the United States as a market. He doesn't look at it as a political challenge. And I think too often the energy debate gets confused in political conversations. Now, because it's energy and more regulated than suits in any one of the delivery chains, there is more governmental involvement because of the regulatory nature of it, but it should be approached in that context. Hydro-Quebec, Enbridge, others and I'm sure both of you already live this life, but need to approach the U.S. market as if you were a U.S. provider, not a Canadian provider coming in saying we want to be treated differently because we're next door and we're nice people and, you know, we're in NAFTA and all of this. It's you're an energy provider to the northeastern United States. So let's talk about this as a commercial transaction that makes sense for the consumers. And if we can do a commercial deal that makes sense for us, this is going to be a terrific marriage. It's clear that Hydro-Québec can be the solution, I think it's clear, to the electricity demand in the northeastern United States for the rest of my life. I don't know that we need to build any power generation in New England or New York if we figure out the commercial relationship. And there's infrastructure issues, but so the consumers in that region need to understand that. To on the fossil fuel side in Western Canada, if you can get Canadian product further into the United States beyond the northern rim and get it to refineries in the southern United States where, what, two-thirds of our refineries are, then we can back out all of that product that we get in from unfriendly countries. So there's a lot of commercial conversation that needs to take place and, I think, less geopolitical conversation.
Sure, and I think that's a fair point, but that also assumes that the rules, how Canadian energy is treated on the U.S. side of the border is the same. And sometimes, as Pam Wallen was pointing out this morning, sometimes rules are brought in that say energy that's being imported into our markets should be treated a different way, and Canada may oil sands is a perfect example with the low carbon fuel standards, for instance.
But let me debate that with you, Velma. That is not what passport the molecules are carrying. That's a debate. There's no question about
sure.
it. But low carbon fuel standards don't identify the nationality of the oil.
Absolutely.
It applies to oil wherever it may come from. It also applies, there the environmental challenges
sure.
in the U.S. are applying to coal as well. And coal today is probably, you'd know better than I, but it probably generates 60% of the power generated in the United States. So coal is a much bigger debate in the United States than it is in Canada, not because the environmental implications are different. The economic implications
sure.
are much different. But it doesn't matter where the coal or where the oil or where the electrons, what their nationality is.
We're back to not being able to tell the nationality of salmon.
But Gordon, I agree on most things, but I think I would argue with you a little bit on that issue. And one of the things that has frustrated Western Canadians to a great extent is that there's this big thing around dirty oil from the oil sands, but California produces heavy oil with exactly the same emission footprint, and it carries a different passport. I've heard no attempt by Governor Schwarzenegger to limit the production of heavy oil in California, and it's got a very heavy carbon footprint, so it does have a different passport.
But the low carbon fuel standards in New England would apply to it. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, sure. But in terms of California's consumption, they are looking at and implementing legislation to limit the high carbon fuel from the oil sands in Canada, but not their own production. And I think that that's a typical distinction people make. You know, if it's mine, it's okay. If it's somebody else's, it's not. So I think there is a bit of a passport around the heavy oil issue.
And welcome to the energy issue, because we get immediately into these kinds of dynamics. I think many of the things that Gordon said are right. These are commercial relationships, and for a lot of reasons, this is why they're taken for granted, because we have had deep energy relationships for many years, and it's just happened unseen because it's happened in a commercial context. But as soon as it starts to meet up with the sustainability side, then we are into a situation where it does also involve passports or regulations or parity of treatment, and I think it does get a little bit more complex there. I wonder if we could go back to the technology piece, because I think for the audience, if you could talk about the two of you, Thierry and Pat, if you could talk about things that you're doing in your company related to technologies or where you see technology trends going. And Gordon, if you could talk about anything that you've seen in terms of cooperation between Canada and the U.S. on technology.
Pat, do you want to start off?
Well, sure, and maybe I'll start off from the point of view of technology from the perspective of our upstream customers, and
sure.
Then I'll talk about pipeline technology, because I think the main technological advances upstream have been in improving the availability and producibility of both oil and natural gas. And we found that particularly on the natural gas side, where through new drilling and fracturing technology, we have dramatically improved the supply of natural gas in North America. And that has resulted in, as you all know, as consumers, relatively low natural gas pricing and the likelihood that we're going to have low natural gas pricing for a long period of time. Huge technological developments in an area where we thought that we had found most of the natural gas to be discovered in North America. Similarly, on the oil side, both on oil sands and other non-conventional oil, very significant technological developments in drilling technology, and in the oil sands, in technology around tailings pond technology and improvement in recoveries from the oil sands. So those have had a very significant impact in terms of pricing of the product and availability.
Looking at it from the electric side, obviously what's happening on the shale gas sector is having a significant impact on electricity also, but more specifically on electricity, you've all heard about smart grid. It's been something, it's more of an umbrella, it covers a number of things, but it's really something that is starting to accelerate. And that means essentially we've been flying a grid that is being, like equivalent of flying a grid blind with very, very unsophisticated technology on the grid. Sophisticated, but not as sophisticated as you would have, for example, in telecom. And that has shifted now, and we're moving into an era where grids are going to become, and how we get electricity to your homes, to your businesses, is going to become much more sophisticated, much more interactive, and that's going to open up a new front in terms of how we do business in electricity, both the way we can improve energy efficiency, and the way we control and operate the grids, how we improve continuous the supply of power to the homes and to the businesses in North America. And that's taking place right now. It's very, very exciting in terms of the technology that's being deployed. Now, there's come back, as people who know have heard me before on the subject know how passionate I am about it, coming back to electrification and transportation, there's tremendous technology being deployed right now and being developed right now around materials. Those of you who've followed the evolution of our societies know how materials science is fundamental. As you improve materials, you can do fantastic things. And what's happening right now around materials, battery materials, is very, very exciting. The U.S. is, and the Obama administration have realized that challenge and have been putting significant dollars at play to basically get very active in that sector. We at Hydro-Québec, for years, have been active in the sector. Now, this is a great story. There was a professor at the University of Texas called Professor Goodenough. And the name that, in terms of research, is an interesting name. And this gentleman is going to be, I'm sure, he's 80-some. He was in Montreal last year. We were hosting the World Congress on Lithium-Ion Batteries. This guy is going to be a Nobel Prize, I'm sure, in the coming years. And he's the father of lithium-ion batteries. You've all heard about lithium-ion. It's all in your cells, your laptops. He did some research to push lithium-ion to the next level with lithium iron phosphate, a much more stable form of lithium ion. But as universities go, University of Texas didn't have, even a fantastic university like the University of Texas, didn't have necessarily the wherewithal to sustain the legal challenges around intellectual property. So Hydro-Québec joined in and said, hey, we're going to, you know, be your friends to take care of the lawyers, and but we want in on the technology. So we picked up the technology. Hydro-Québec is now the owner of that technology, lithium iron phosphate. You're going to hear about that. This is lithium ion stable in a stable form, in a very, very dense form, and it's going to allow electric transportation to go to the next level. So that's why I'm very excited about, you know, some of the products that are coming out. The initial phases of the cars that you're going to see are not going to have this, but if you think of the second, third generations, you're going to hear about lithium iron phosphate. And that is a technology in which we're going to be quite active. And it's a technology that's going to allow electric transportation to go to the next level. There's other technologies around the titanium, Titanet in French, which allow very fast recharge. We've developed a battery with Taiwanese partners in the standard form, the 18650 form, these battery cells, that you can recharge fully in 5 minutes at 120 volts, not, you know, not 400 volts, at 120 volts, using Titanet on the anode side of the batteries. So materials technology is going to create tremendous opportunities in electricity, both in the way we use it and the way we produce it. And I think we have some very, very exciting years in front of us.
First, let me say I'm entirely in favor of taking care of the lawyers. it's a good concept, and if there's one theme that comes out of this panel,
That's the takeaway.
We will all agree.
Giffen wants to take care of the lawyers to be the one that comes on the panel.
And since I am a lawyer and not an engineer, probably me talking about technology is dangerous, but I will say that we're in a very, I think, inspiring period in our government, for example, in the energy field, because mm-hmm. we have a scientist who is the Secretary of Energy
right.
and somebody who really does understand more than the typical person that would be in a high policy position like that, what technology can do for us going forward and how leaps in technology may be able to solve a number of our problems, both in terms of energy usage and also in terms of the climate challenges.
Right.
I'm one of those who firmly believes that we don't have to turn everything upside down. We need to be, again, responsible. In order to address all of the challenges we're confronting in the energy and environment space, because I firmly believe that, as in many of our challenges historically, that technology will help us solve these challenges. It may not be next week, but it'll be sooner than we think, and I do believe that electrification of some of the light vehicle usage in the U.S. is going to be one of those solutions. We also have some dumb technology that's got to be addressed, though. I mean, just in the transmission grid in the U.S., we don't have a lot of smart transmission. And in some cases, we don't even have enough dumb transmission. you could light up Manhattan if you could get it there. And I suspect that between here and Manhattan, we've got some gaps in the transmission capacity. So I don't mean to suggest we ought to put in low-grade transmission just to get it there, but while we're searching for the future, we got to deal with next week, too. So I hope we don't leap past the need for, again, in the U.S., we've got 330 million consumers. You've got 33 million nationwide. So we've got a lot of infrastructure issues, pipeline transmission that have got to be addressed in the short run, before we get to the future.
So what do you think we could do to start to focus the Canada-U.S. conversation on infrastructure? Because I think infrastructure is something, the transmission piece for getting Canadian energy in whatever form, or pipelines into the U.S., too often the conversation is somewhere else. What do you think it would take to focus the conversation more on that shared interest in common infrastructure?
Well, I regret, actually, that wasn't a centerpiece of the so-called stimulus money that was being spent, because there's a lot of jobs that can be created just in the infrastructure development. And people talk, in the U.S. at least, about roads and bridges all the time. Well, energy infrastructure would be a good long-term investment, and we spent a lot of money
right.
In connection with trying to stimulate the economy that I think some larger percentage of it could have gone to energy infrastructure. But again, I think there's a commercial dialogue to be had in the U.S. about how to address these challenges. And little by little, the light's going on about the energy from the north, both fossil fuel and electricity. But it's because these guys, literally, are going to the United States and they're talking to people about it and educating people on the opportunities.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in all fairness, we have to get our act together also in terms of, for example, making sure that we have the resource. It's one thing to focus on transmission and electricity, but if you don't have the resource developing,
sure,
you're not going to
a lot of changes for you
doing much with it. So that it took a while, and certainly in terms of how we go about from an environmental, from a social acceptability, working with First Nations in Quebec, really getting our act together in terms of putting the projects forward. And that's we're there, and that's moving. And the commercial discussions are taking place. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago and meeting up people all the way down in Manhattan, the deputy mayor, et cetera, and they're interested. I mean, they get it. They understand how it's fundamental that we play a part of that. We can't, not necessarily going to be all of it, but that we need to be part of it. So we have projects right now that are moving forward in terms of a major new, highway into deep New England, using up to the moment technology, direct current technology, 1,200 megawatt facility. We've had great discussions in terms of finally breaking the logjam in New York, not because of difficulty with Canadian energy, but just the fact that it is difficult. The U.S. Northeast is a densely populated. There's a complexity to developing these infrastructures, so it can take a while. But I'm sensing that there's a lot of traction now on this, and finally getting it done, and having Quebec be a contributing factor to that. So I think that's developing right now, and I'm quite optimistic for the coming years.
Do you want to add anything here?
What I'm going to suggest is idealistic and it won't work. So you can probably all
this is the right crowd. This is the right crowd for something like that.
One of the challenges that we've got in the hydrocarbon infrastructure business in trying to get more focused on Canada-U.S. relations is the fact that the energy and environment issues are so tightly linked. And to give you a very good example of that, one of our competitors is trying to get approval for a new crude oil pipeline to the U.S. right now. It's been delayed, I think, 32 months in trying to get their approval from the State Department in the U.S., not because of any concern around security of supply. In fact, the State Department is very supportive of the importance of Canadian oil for security supply in the U.S., but it's the environmental issue and it's the dirty oil issue that's preventing the approval, and the State Department having to make sure they go through the proper consultation process. And I realize that it's impossible to separate the two. They're tightly linked. But this is one of the reasons why I have called for, as have a number of other Canadian CEOs, for an energy strategy for this company. And that might sound strange for somebody from Calgary. It sounds like I'm calling for another national energy policy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not doing that.
It's a good thing that you're the only person in this room who could have put those three words together in a sentence.
And it is an energy strategy that I think, going back to something that Gordon mentioned earlier, we're going to need all sources of energy in order to develop the society we're in to where we really want to go. There is a role for coal. There's a role for crude oil, for natural gas, for hydro, for everything that we can possibly do. Because to tell you the truth, there's still in the range of 1 billion people in the world that live without access to energy, something that we take for granted here. Maybe if we had an energy strategy that said our intent is to phase out hydrocarbons over a period of time, but in the meantime, we have to get on with facilitating the projects that bring energy to the people that need it, that we could all get together and recognize that we have to facilitate some of these energy projects rather than stand in the way of them. And I know, Gordon, from one of your other lives, it's been very frustrating for you to watch the delays on this process on the pipeline approval as well. But it's so interlinked with the environment that we can't just focus on the energy.
Yeah, I think, though, it's important to realize there are some number of people who the natural conclusion of their thinking is that we all ought to freeze in the dark, right? I mean, meaning that no source of energy in the final analysis is acceptable. They'll argue about a pipeline and say we ought to be transitioning to something, or an oil pipeline, say we ought to be transitioning to natural gas. Then when we get to natural gas, they'll be against the fracking process that releases the natural gas from the shale. Then when they finish with that, they'll move on to whether or not flooding land is environmentally sensitive. And at some point, you just got to turn off all the lights and you can't go anywhere, right? So we just have to recognize that it's you can't please all of the people all of the time. And truthfully, I know I sound defensive about this, but it's the pipeline issues aren't just about the molecules passports from Alberta. Some of the pipeline issues are the regular old not in my backyard issues, the aquifer issues in the mid-continent. I think they can all be addressed on the merits in a successful way, but they're not all about the fact that it's coming from Canada.
Oh, no, not at all. I agree fully. And it is much more the heavy oil or dirty oil issue than it is Canada. And then, like you say, some regional and not in my backyard issues.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the oil sands issue dominates all of what is already a very diverse and complex energy conversation. I'm going to go to Adam in just a few minutes, but I'm going to take this opportunity, Gordon, to pick up on something that you and I talked about earlier this week in preparing for this. And you talked about how sometimes Canada sends mixed messages on energy and on other issues. I think you were waxing on about some other issues, but it is the case that Canada sometimes sends mixed messages. Can you talk about what impact that has on the U.S. side of the border? And then I'm going to turn to the two of you and talk about how we can do a better job of getting our act together in Canada.
Well, I don't think there are any mixed messages on energy and the environment at this stage, right? But when I was U.S. ambassador here during the Kyoto process, instructed by Bill Clinton, I came to the government of Canada and I said, why don't we have a North American strategy to address how we go into Kyoto? Because the Europeans are showing up with a strategy that is actually an economic strategy in the guise of an environmental policy. They're trying to disadvantage North America from an economic point of view, trying to sound like they're green. The government of Canada's answer to us at that time was, no, we're going to be greener than you guys.
Right.
We're not going to have a common set of policies. So fast forward 10 years, now the government of Canada is saying to the United States, we need to have a collaborative, cooperative, harmonized energy and environmental policy, both to deal with the global challenges, but also to deal with the fact that we want to sell more of what we have in the United States. I think they're in the right place today. But that's just an example within a decade. The view from the north has changed almost 180 degrees. But that said, nobody's holding it against anyone. We're in the right place now, where we're talking about what we have is a North American energy market. And the last time I checked, there's no hermetic seal at the 49th parallel, right. So we're obviously sharing. You talked about acid rain earlier today. You know, for a while, people south of the border were a little tone deaf about the fact that what we were doing in Ohio was affecting people's streams in Canada. I think we get all of that now. We're headed in the right direction. The clean energy dialogue that Jim Prentice started with Secretary Chu, I think, is an extraordinarily constructive place to have some of these conversations. Prentice did a lot while he was in that job, and the momentum needs to continue.
Yeah, I think Canada's been frustrated of late that Canada may be in the right place now, but the U.S. is a little distant. But, yeah. It often happens in our relationship. So just, again, turning to the two of you, one of the ways that Canada tends not to have its act together on energy domestically, yeah. or where we have tensions, maybe. Sherry, yeah. I see you reacting. Yeah. I just want to talk about our internal Canadian dynamics and the fact that, going back to those three words that I wouldn't say because I live in Ottawa now, but the historic federal government coming into Alberta and Albertans' knee-jerk reaction to anything that would have the word national in a conversation about energy, and Quebec's position on this. So can the two of you, not going beyond your commercial interests, but comment as people operating in those jurisdictions what it might take for us to have a national energy conversation that's mindful of both Alberta and Quebec's position on these issues?
Yeah. Obviously, I'm not going to touch the politics of that.
I knew you wouldn't.
And I'd push back a bit in terms of the way I don't always understand the view in Ottawa, but I'm fairly close to what Ambassador Giffen's saying. You know, right now, when I go down to the U.S., be it New England, New York, Washington, you know, I meet with Chairman Wellinghoff at the FERC, when I meet with governors in Massachusetts, elsewhere, and they, you know, hear our story. They say, you know, I talk to a very wide spectrum, from, you know, Ed Markey to the other side of the aisle in Washington. They say, you know, this is a great story. Just let's get it done. And so there's really not much pushback. You know, we've got to deal with the issues in terms of commercial issues, but they're standard. And I'm feeling pretty optimistic. So I'd say that, you know, right now we're in a world where there's no difference in philosophy of how we want to approach this. And, you know, it's up to us to just get it done.
And
truthfully, on the U.S. side, again, unrelated to the passport, there are commercial issues. There are debates about what constitutes renewable energy, right?
Sure.
And a lot of those debates are not as principled as we would hope. They're more, I happen to have an interest in a business that produces windmills.
Sure.
I think only wind power is renewable and hydro isn't. It's not something that anybody has against Quebec. They have a commercial interest. So we're having a commercial debate in some of these things as opposed to a national debate.
Sure. And Terry, do you think that the temperature is calmed down between Alberta and Quebec on energy?
I think we've always had some great, great relations. Last night we had a conversation with some great friends out of Calgary on this. I mean, there are two areas of the country that understand energy. It has to be Quebec, not taking anything away from our good friends in Ontario, but it has to be Quebec and Alberta. I mean, we understand energy. We look at energy as a vital resource, something that we've been deeply involved in. It's a big, big business in Alberta, obviously. It has been for decades, and it's obviously something very significant in Quebec also. And we look at it in terms of a north-south, one of saying, you know, sometimes, you know, to the federal government of saying, hey, you know, don't get too involved. Things are, you know, we're moving in the right direction, and just let it happen.
Great. We'll go to questions in a minute if folks want to go to the microphone. Pat, I'll give you the last word here.
So, yes, I'm sure we Canadians sometimes give conflicting stories, but I think that's pretty typical of most people around the world. Gordon told me back in the winter that we were giving a very conflicting story because we claim in Canada that we're such modest, quiet-spoken people, and yet we developed this slogan, own the podium. And he said that was inconsistent and that we couldn't claim we were going to own the podium at the Olympics and also be claiming to be modest. But yes, we sometimes are. I think, though, that's just typical. It comes with regional differences. It comes with the breadth of this country. And it's hence something that we've been born with and we will always live with. If we were, for example, Singapore, it's much easier to develop a unified approach to most everything because you're in a geographically confined area and it's just simpler than it is when you're spread out as we are. So I think that naturally that happens. I will say that right now, and I mentioned this to Terry before we came into the room, that it's very easy for him probably to find people unified in their acceptance of hydroelectric. there was a day when hydro wasn't so widely accepted. Right now, I'm the bad guy in the room because we moved crude oil, and it has really got the label of the bad guy. There was a day when we were the good guy in the room. And so right now, we find quite conflicting stories when we visit regulators in California versus those in North or South Dakota. And so we get different stories from the U.S. as well.
It's okay. But people always hate lawyers, so I don't even I don't get the upside.
Yeah. So, but I think it comes with being Canadian. We're never all going to think exactly. And I think that's good, by the way.
And do you think Alberta's passed a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to not wanting to have a national energy conversation? It was you who suggested it first at this panel.
Yeah.
And in fact, the editorial in the Calgary Herald today calls for a national energy strategy.
You know, I first called for it at a forum in Ottawa back about 5 years ago, and I hardly dared return to Calgary because it was interpreted as national energy policy. But I think now more and more people are separating the two. We're not talking about fiscal policy or any kind of similar system. We're talking about a strategy so that we can try to reach some kind of a consensus, if that's possible, on the importance of developing the different kinds of energy at the right paces to bring this energy and environment issue into balance.
Thank you. Adam, can I go to you for
yep.
a couple of questions?
Sure. So Alice from Toronto has a question, and it is, what are your opinions on the recent emphasis on using biofuels and the implications of this move on food security?
Go ahead.
You're going. You can sense that we're... I mean, how would I say this? Biofuels, if you're going to grow corn and you're going to convert corn into a biofuels, I think that's a strange business. On the long term, in terms of, you know, starting the process and to get the biofuel sector going, perhaps, but you have to move to, you know, a cellulosic biofuel at some point, algae-based biofuels at some point, but not, you know, corn-based biofuels. I mean, opposing food and fuel is not something that I think is very sustainable.
Tends to be fuel prices more than fuel security, because doing
right.
what you just suggested raises the price of corn. There's less corn available to feed hogs, for example. Price of pork goes up, you know,
yeah,
in order to have 6 gallons of biofuel. You know.
Yeah, there's a trickle down. Adam, do you have one more question?
Yep, sure. Melanie from Montreal. She asks, has there been much work done to encourage the expansion of hydroelectricity across the Quebec border into the United States and to neighboring Canadian provinces? And if not, what kind of steps need to be taken to make such initiatives possible?
Seems that we have to. She's in Montreal.
Maybe she's calling from your building.
I need to have some of my PR people talk to
you. Your message is getting out.
Has to be the language. Listen, we've been at this pretty hard for. I've been at Hydro-Québec for 15 years, and the first thing I did when I got there, and you remember this, perhaps some of you remember the story. I was in the started in oil, went into petrochemicals, the natural gas, and finally in electricity in Hydro-Québec back 15 years ago. We got there, we looked, and where are the projects? I mean, you know, it's great business. Where are the projects? Well, the projects were, you know, somewhere very deep in the organization, but not going very far. And it was really about relationships mm-hmm. to First Nations. And I can tell you that I spent a lot of time getting to know these people, going up and spending time out there in the woods and talking about, you know, the land and the things that we share in. Over years, and this was not a function of months, this was a function of years, and setting up relations. I mean, and those relations led to the ability to discuss and to plan for the future in a responsible way. And that was really the foundation of getting back at large hydro projects. Let's start with the Tuna Stew project. The Tuna Stew project was the first large project after 1996. And I spent a lot of time with one of the chiefs and his people. And he taught me how to trap a rabbit, and how to set up the trap. So we went out in the bush, each community has a different way of setting up the snares, etc. And we spent a lot of time talking about this, etc. You do that over, you know, years, and visiting and talking, and you get the projects. So right now we're very active, and that's why we're investing $5 billion a year in large hydro and the transmission to get it to markets. And those markets, I mean, there is some growth in Quebec, which we love, but a lot of the growth is for us in terms of the very deep market that is there in New England, New York, that we want to reach.
Yeah, and you're facing many of these First Nations issues for your pipeline.
Exactly, we are. And, in fact, I asked Terry for some advice earlier today, and I think I just got it. So, yes, we are. We're facing significant First Nations challenges on our gateway projects on the West Coast. We are working very closely with First Nations and hope that we're going to be able to bring them on side in support of the project.
But I think Terry may have just given you a project.
I'll yes, he did.
Go here to the microphone.
Yes,
if we can
thank
have
you.
Your question, please.
My name is John Foster from Carleton University. Coming back to the issue of energy strategy for Canada, we're aware that the United States, under the Bush administration, in a sense, has put a lot of emphasis on a national strategy. And Presidents Bush and Vice President Cheney put a lot of energy into this, some of it in public and some of it quite secret. And we've recently been reminded that of the priority the U.S. puts on this and the usefulness of their strategic petroleum reserve, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given the proportionality clause in our bilateral and trilateral agreements regarding energy, which put U.S. needs first, can you foresee a Canadian national energy strategy that would at least get us onto an even or balanced playing field in terms of the security of supply needs of Canadian consumers vis-a-vis U.S. demands?
I think you're talking about two things. One is that Canada will want a strategy for itself.
Yes.
And then you're talking about correcting an imbalance that exists in the existing bilateral agreement.
Well, they're definitely interconnected because
yes.
you can't put Canadian at the current situation. You can't make Canadian consumer needs equivalent in the case of shortage
sure.
to American demands.
Yeah. So I do think the answer to that is yes, we can. You know, under the free trade agreement with the U.S. There is free flow of energy across the border. However, with the energy supplies that we have in Canada, we should have more than adequate energy for our own need. And I think a strategy around the development of that would ensure that not only is that the case, but that export to the U.S. continues to be a very important part of the strategy. So I think even if the U.S. pulled its full supply, that we're not going to run short in Canada. We've got an excess of energy supply in Canada.
Even in a situation of peak oil?
Even in a situation of peak oil. Now, you know, if you assumed, for example, that all of U.S. imports were shut off from around the world, then we don't have enough energy to supply the U.S. and Canada combined. But I don't think that we would need to develop a strategy that goes to that extreme because there is plenty of oil around the world as well.
Yeah, and I mean, we are seeing a diversification of energy across the board in our bilateral relationship and in how both countries are gaining access to their energy needs.
Hello, my name is Philippe Duguay, and I just finished my coursework at McGill in law. My second question of the day will be much less pointed than the previous one for Mr. Vandel. I should lay my biases out on the table. I'm a researcher in wind energy governance, and I also was an advisor to the African Wind Energy Association in Cape Town, South Africa. You'd be surprised how many Canadian and American companies are doing wind business in South Africa right now. I have a question about the role. How do you envision the future role of Hydro-Québec in spurring on the marketplace for the small-scale application of renewable energy. That is to say, where is the role of Hydro-Québec in making both businesses, small businesses, homes? You alluded a little bit to battery R&D in University of Texas and whatnot. But I'm hoping you can just expand upon that and tell me how you think Hydro-Québec is going to be acting to make renewable energy, not just big energy business, but also localized energy business that's more approachable.
Yep. I guess you're referring to distributed, what we call distributed energy. So on the wind side, as you know, we've been very, very active. We're going to be up to, close to 4,000 megawatts. That's 10% of the installed capacity of producing electricity in Quebec is going to be wind by 2015, around 2015. So we've been very active. You're talking about billions of dollars. But in there, what we said, hey, you know, what useful role can we play? And I'll come back to the other distributed, but in wind power, we said, what useful role can we play? And the most useful role that we thought we could play was to make sure that we were integrating wind power in an efficient way. Because it's one thing to have wind power and solar, et cetera, but it can be done very inefficiently. Mm-hmm. Look at Germany. Look at Spain to some extent. You know, sometimes when the wind is running hard, there's problems on the transmission. But we said, we don't want to go there. We're going to be integrating that wind, but in a way that ensures that we're not cannibalizing, that one form of renewable energy is not cannibalizing another form of renewable energy, hydro. So that's where we focused on. In terms of distributed energy, there's smaller wind, perhaps, but really if you come down and think of it, there's really about solar to some extent, and geothermal to some extent, biomass perhaps to some extent. And there, it's really a function of economics. And we've stayed away. Hydro-Québec stayed away from the approach of feed-in tariffs like they've done in Ontario. We couldn't rationalize the idea of buying wind solar power at 50 cents a kilowatt hour when we're selling at 7, and then sending that bill to everyone to subsidize that power. It may develop over time. So we said, let's be smart about this. Let's focus on things like building codes, improving building codes, passive solar. If you're going to build, you might as well build by using natural solar presence. So that's where we put our focus. In terms of geothermal, we're going to be doing a little more. But the economics are not that difficult, that easy. One area where we're going to be putting in dollars in terms of technology is improved heat pumps. There's tremendous potential in terms of improving the technology around heat pumps, cold weather heat pumps, air type of heat pumps, and so a technology play in those segments. The other area that we're working on, I'll close on that, is what we call hydrolien, basically inflow, in-stream turbines. Very small. There's one in the St. Lawrence, just near Pont de la Concorde, for those who know Montreal, that was installed there. And it's a technology in which we're active, and we see that as being very, very promising for northern communities, which are always pretty close to river, and where this can be basically displacing diesel, because diesel is used in all those communities. So if we can displace some of the diesel, you don't have to transport it, you don't have to store it. And you improve the environmental footprint of producing power. So, multi-front, but on solar economics, we're not where Ontario is.
And Pat,
maybe just to very quickly put some further numbers to that. We're also in the wind and solar business. We operate the largest photovoltaic solar facility in the world. We generate solar power at 43 cents. To Terry's point, it sells on the grid for 6 cents. It has to be heavily subsidized. Wind is around 11 or 12 cents. So really, I think the answer is to when we're going to get more renewables is on the other side of the stage, and that it's with the general public, and whether the public will absorb the incremental cost of renewables. That will come down with technology over time, but rooftop solar, for example, is about 85 or 86 cents a kilowatt hour. So, it becomes a real challenge to try to produce that economically.
Yeah. So this is the last question. This gentleman at the microphone here.
I'll try and make it a good one. Hi, my name is Michael Morgenthau. I go to McGill. I'm interested in your discussion about the need for collaboration with the United States vis-a-vis fighting climate change. Unfortunately, the Obama administration wasn't able to push through its cap-and-trade program. Mm-hmm. Some might then argue that Canada should pursue its own either cap-and-trade program or a shift of taxes from income to carbon. What do you think the implications would be if Canada were to go ahead on its own and bring out this program before the United States did so?
Well, just a very quick answer, and I'm sure that Terry and Gordon have got responses to that as well. But as I mentioned, if we were to apply a penalty, for example, in Canada that resulted in higher cost energy, then we would not attract the investment dollars to develop our energy at the same rate as would be the case for a similar investment in the U.S. Taking something like the Bakken oil play, which straddles the border, the investment dollars would go into North Dakota rather than Saskatchewan. So that would disadvantage Canadian producers, and that's why I think it has to be harmonized.
Terry, quickly?
I'd say that the economists would tell you carbon tax, the lawyers would tell you cap and trade, and the engineer in me will tell you technology. So think technology.
And you'll get to reduce the
CO2.
Gordon? Do you want to comment on
this? This is a lawyer that said earlier it would be technology, so I endorse that. It doesn't make a lot of sense, really, to have dramatically different regimes for the reason that it's not a hermetically sealed 49th parallel, right? So, I mean, the economics and the environmental considerations don't point to that being a prudent course.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you all. In closing, yesterday David Johnson was talking in an educational context about being able to make education principles not mutually exclusive but mutually reinforcing. And I hope we've been able to show that there are a lot of things happening in the energy and sustainability conversation that are pushing us towards a more mutually reinforcing conversation than a mutually exclusive conversation.
Okay, Velma, thank you, and thank you all. A great session. So, Pat, rabbit hunting is the key, and watch out for the tracks. But it'll be cheaper than hiring high-priced consultants, that's for sure. Okay, we want to thank you all for a great session, especially Velma, our moderator, did a fantastic job. And to thank our panel, we've invited a McGill student, Evan Akriotis, who's president of the Canadian Studies Association of Undergraduate Students here at McGill, I believe. Evan?
I have the privilege of thanking each of our panelists and our moderator for their thoughtful discussion of an important issue in Canada-U.S. relations and one that is only going to become more important over time. So on behalf of McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and McGill University, thank you very much.
Now we are having a break, and we'll ask you to come back here in 15 minutes for the final session with the Premier of Quebec and the Governor of Vermont.